The conference.
James, Director of BioCenter, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this third call in BioCenter's Thought Leader Conference, teleconference series for 2011-2012, entitled Future of Humanity, Are We Ready for Humanity 2.0? So we're very, very glad that you're able to join us this afternoon. Just a couple of housekeeping arrangements to go through before we get underway with the real meat of the conversation. As per the confirmation email you should have received from me, please keep your line muted through the call so we're not disturbed by any extraneous sounds that might be happening at your end that then get multiplied amongst us all. So please remember *0 to mute or unmute your line. And at this stage, you should have all joined muted. So I think we can kind of safely say everyone's muted at the moment. But when we come to the Q&A, and I will see draw people in to pose their questions, *0 is the combination to mute and unmute your line. Secondly, if you have a question or comment that you'd like to raise, please do email it through to me at my address, which you should have received the confirmation email from. That's matt.james@bioethics.ac.uk. matt.james@bioethics.ac.uk at any point during the call. So if any of our speakers says something that you're particularly interested in or it triggers something in your thinking, please don't hold on to the end. Email it straight through to me and then I can begin to manage the flow of questions as we move into Q&A, and I'll call upon you to pose your question at the appropriate time. As with all our public events, the call will be recorded so as to allow those who are unable to be with us this afternoon to listen in at a later date, and they'll be downloadable from our website. I will be emailing everyone who is able to join us this afternoon once they're ready to download from our site, so you'll be aware of when you can do that. The format roughly for the afternoon will be kind of 10 minutes a statement from each of our guest speakers, and then we'll have a period of Q&A where we'll be able to pose questions and enter into a conversation on the issues raised, and then I'll probably call upon our two speakers to close with some final comments and reflections. A brief word about BioCenter. For those of you that may be joining us for the first time and may be coming into contact with us for the first time, BioCenter is a think tank based in Westminster in London, looking at the ethical, social and political implications presented by new emerging technologies. However, one of our distinctives is that unlike most other think tanks, we're concerned as much about the conversation and how the questions are framed as to the various topics that we address. We're concerned about how the questions are framed as we are about the answers. So in seeking to host this conversation, our aim is to try and bring together all articulate perspectives, even those that are controversial and perhaps maybe sidelined at times, bring those into the conversation so we can have a rich and meaningful debate. So far in this series of thought leader teleconferences, we've had Professor Steve Fuller from the University of Warwick, author of the recent book Humanity 2.0, What It Means to Be Human, Past, Present and Future. And with his particular interest in sociology, philosophy, technology, and how that has a reflection and impact on the political order, we were able to have a really good conversation with him regarding how his perspectives are framed as regards to what it means to be human and the concepts, the changing concepts of biology and our biological understanding. And we then followed that up with, just before Christmas, a teleconference with Justina Robson, probably one of the leading UK sci-fi authors, offering her perspectives on the future of humanity with particular regard to AI developments. All of those conversations, teleconferences, are downloadable from our website. And when I email everyone to say that this one's live and downloadable, I'll also include the links to those previous two as well, so you can take a look at those at your leisure if you haven't already come across them. But back to this afternoon's discussion. Entitled More Than Human? We have two speakers this afternoon, kind of our key speaker and then a respondent. Our first speaker this afternoon is Neil Harbison. Neil is a contemporary artist, a composer and cyborg activist, best known for his ability to hear colours and to perceive colours outside the ability of human vision. In 2004, I believe, he became the first person in the world to wear an eyeborg, and the inclusion of this eyeborg on his passport photo caused quite a bit of controversy, caused a stir amongst the passport authorities, but he was successful finally in being officially recognised as a cyborg. The colour and use of technology as an extension of the performer is also an interest of Neil's, and his growing interest in cyborgs and the cyborg approach to their life led to him in 2010 to set up the Cyborg Foundation, an international organisation to help humans become cyborgs. So without further ado, Neil, we're delighted to have you with us. The floor is yours, and as I say, up to about 10 minutes, if you'd like to make an opening statement, then we can proceed with the rest of the conversation.
Sorry, I was muted.
There we go, excellent. Thank you, Neil.
Just happy to be here and to talk about how exciting it is to use technology as part of the body to help us extend the senses and extend the perception we have of reality.
Great. Well, over to you to expound upon that and your changing perceptions of humanity and basically your experience as a cyborg, really.
Yeah, well, I was born with this visual condition that only allows me to see in black and white. But I've been using an electronic eye attached to my head since 2004 that allows me to hear color. And, well, at the beginning, the use of technology to hear color was just a kind of a tool. I used it. It was like it was giving me information, but after some time and after wearing it constantly attached to my head for 24 hours a day and for several months, it started to become a part of my body. I stopped feeling the difference between my brain and the software. So the union between the software and the brain created this new sense of color, and I started to perceive color automatically. I didn't have to think about the notes of the color. It all became more automatic. And then after some time, it even became a feeling. So I started to have favorite colors, and I started to dream in color. So it was when the software and my brain united and created this sense that I felt I understood the word cyborg, which is simply the union between an organism and cybernetics. And that's what I feel has happened to me. Now I've been wearing the electronic eye attached to my head permanently for more than 8 years, and I completely feel that this electronic eye is not an electronic equipment, but a part of my body, and an extension of my brain and an extension of my senses. And I find this so exciting to be able to extend perception that I actually, when I got to 360 colors, when I was able to perceive each degree of the color wheel, I felt it wasn't enough, and I knew that with technology I could even extend the color perception further to infrared colors or ultraviolet colors. So I decided to continue extending my color perception, so now I can actually hear colors that are not visible for human eyes, and it can even go even further. So I find that this use of technology can allow us to perceive things that we've never been able to perceive, but that other animal species can perceive, like ultraviolet. There's some birds that can perceive these colors, but there's many other senses that we can extend by using technology applied to the body. So I also received many emails from people interested in extending senses, and that's why 2 years ago I decided to create the Cyborg Foundation, which is a foundation that wants to help people become cyborgs, help people use technology not as a tool but as a part of the body, and in order to extend perceptions or senses. I think that when we stop using technology as a tool and we start using it as part of the body, we'll see a very big change in society, when we'll be able to regain a lot of senses or perceptions that we've probably lost due to the constant use we have of technology as a tool or as a helping tool. If we use technology as a part of us, then we regain senses, and we can actually try to have the same senses as other animal species. Because if we compare ourselves, humans, with other animals, we really see that we perceive very little. We only compare ourselves with a dog. The dog can hear much better than us, that he can smell much better than us, and we can actually extend our senses if we use technology as part of the body. So I find this very exciting, this use of technology as an integrated part of ourselves.
Okay, well, thank you very much for those opening comments and reflections. There's much there that's triggering off in my mind that I'd like to follow up with, but I will restrain. I'm simply the convener, the chair this afternoon, so I want to bring others in as well. Dr. Pete Moore is our kind of respondent this afternoon, just to bring some prepared comments and reflections to this. Pete is a science communicator and the author of the book Enhancing Me, The Hope and Hype of Human Enhancement. So it's somebody that I know has researched into this whole area and has interviewed a number of people involved in not only the technology but also in the use of enhancement technology. So I'm sure he would be very interested to learn more about Neil's cyborg enhancements. So Pete, over to you for 10 minutes or maximum 10 minutes of reflection and response to what Neil's had to share so far, and then we can open up the conversation to the rest of the callers.
Thank you very much, Matt. And Neil, good to hear from you. So far I've been learning about you by looking on the web and watching the various videos and things, and it triggers all sorts of thoughts in my mind that it'll be lovely to present in questions, and I'm sure there's plenty of others who want to do so as well. My thoughts as I come at these sorts of examples are to try to work out within it exactly what is new, what is exceptional, what is enhancing. And because to my mind, the notion, as Neil's described, as a cyborg, is to extend beyond, to develop extra. And we have an interesting time trying to define a cyborg, what level of technology is required in order to call that a technology that is enough to bolt on. For myself, I wear glasses. They're very much part of me. They've been part of me since I was four. And when I was four, I was blind in one eye. And having had the glasses in front, and they're very technical lenses, the brain, the visual centers behind, have actually responded to that and developed. So the glasses plus me combined has delivered me to the point where I can actually see quite well in my right eye, so long as I've got the glasses on, but I can't without. Glasses are allowed in a passport photograph, so long as the bar of the frame doesn't go through the eye. So to what extent does that make me a passport ratified cyborg as well? And you get hearing aids that are built in, very technically built in. So some of the questions that I want to explore around are: what's the step changes that are involved in Neil's device, and that actually transport us into a new territory? It looks great fun, and it has very interesting applications in the way that he's using it in the artistic environment, and that'll be fun to explore as well. We also get into the debate as to, with these sorts of technologies, at what point are they therapy and at what point they're enhancing. And in Neil's case, it started as a response to color blindness, a particular form of color blindness. But has it stayed a therapy, or is it an enhancement, or is it doing something really very new? And I think that'll be a fun area to explore with Neil as well. Just looking down a couple of other notes. I'm quite keen in the use of words as we go through things, to use words well and to use words carefully. In describing Neil, I said that he had an eye attached to his head. I'd like to explore the sort of resolution of this device to see how well it maps up against something that I'd call an eye. Is it a photo sensor? Is it a light sensor? Is it a camera? what sort of words do we need to use to be actually describing things as they are and not stretching things beyond? Because where they are is fabulous and doing great things. So let's work to keep our definitions and our words in appropriate places. So I'm looking forward to exploring. I'd like to know more about the technology that's fitted on, the processing that's in it, the ability to resolve different colors, the extent to which it can pick out patches of photos, patches of pictures, what happens when it looks at a kaleidoscope. Do you get a chord from it, or is it a monotone the whole time? Lots of questions that I'm keen to ask, and I think it would be better to move us now to a question time and to hear more from Neil that way.
Great, yes, absolutely, Pete. But thanks very much for kind of helping to, at least with some broad strokes, just map out some of the rich territory that we can pursue in exploring this further with Neil. For those of you that are joining the call, perhaps missed my very brief introduction at the beginning, if you'd like to email through to me your questions, then I can begin to call in people and draw people in and call you in at the right time so you can mute and unmute so we don't get a whole load of extra sound coming through as well. My email address is matt.james@bioethics.ac.uk. It's the email address that you should have received the information about the call through. So please do start emailing through your questions to me at that address. But if we can come back, kind of responding from Pete's comments there, Neil, to you, could you perhaps just expand upon the kind of the technology which is involved with your iBorg and perhaps some of the points that Pete was saying there, how it works? One thing I'd be interested in, is it actually part of you, or could it actually be kind of unplugged? Terminology about the eye, is it a resolution? What kind of resolution is it? That kind of thing. If we can come back to you and explore some of the technology particularly.
Yeah, well, it's a color sensor between my eyes that goes to a chip installed at the back of my head, and the chip transforms the light frequencies into sound frequencies, and then I hear the different sounds through the bone. Instead of using my ears, I use my bone to hear colors. But at the beginning, it was a software that worked with a computer. So I was, the beginning, it was a webcam installed at my head that was connected to a computer. And the computer had a software that transformed the colors into sounds, and then I used headphones. But through the years, I've been collaborating with different computer scientists to make it smaller and more portable. Now, the next step is to have it osteointegrated. In September, in a hospital in Barcelona, I won't be hearing color through pressure through the bone, but it will be in the bone. So it will be... there will be like a mini jack entrance in the back of my head that will allow me to hear colors directly in the bone. Now it's by pressure, but the next step is to have it osteointegrated. But the main thing to me, it's never been the union between the technology and the head, but the software and the brain. The real connection was when I started to hear electronic sounds in my dreams, because my brain was creating the electronic sounds that I was hearing all the time. So it really, my interest was always the union between the software and the brain, not actually the headset and the head. But now it will be more integrated due to this osteointegration.
So at the moment, the technology is all external to your head.
Yes. Well, it will always...
It's strapped onto the outside.
It's by pressure to the bone, yeah.
Yeah.
But there's nothing in the bone, and I don't need to have for example, the chip doesn't need to be in the skin, because it's not used for me to have it in the skin, because I keep developing it further. So
absolutely.
So it's much more practical to have the chip outside, not inside.
Yeah. And in terms of the camera itself, what sort of angle does it come out? Does it have quite a narrow field of view? Is it a broad field of view? Because when I've seen you in videos using it, now I don't know how new the videos are or old they are, you seem to have to bring objects really quite close in order to pinpoint particular colors. How does that work in practice?
Well, I hear like the dominant color. Well, if I go into a room, I hear the dominant color of the room. And then if I want to hear the specific colors of each object, then I get closer and then I hear the specific colors. This could be changed and I could have like a detector of my eyes that can detect what I'm looking at. But for now, I'm not interested in that. I quite like perceiving the dominant color of a space, and then getting closer if I'm interested in knowing the specific colors of objects.
Have you ever tried making it play a chord if you see a picture that has a variety of colors in?
Well, I create chords when I just unite the colors that I see, and then I create the chord like face portraits. Instead of, I listen to the different parts of a face, and then I create a chord from it. But I don't listen it live, but I create it afterwards. Yeah.
And out of interest, Neil, one of the things that Pete was saying about use of words and terminology and how you refer to your new eye, and I think what Pete was then saying, whether that actually married up with, say, the human eye, how do you respond to those kind of challenging questions or the comparison between a human eye and what you now have in the form of your eyeball? What's the difference do you see in terms of resolution, and do you see the term almost evolving, like your eyeball being an evolutionary, more enhanced version of the eye, or the human eye?
Well, I think the good thing about the electronic eye is that I can actually make it better through the years. So in 5 years, it would be much better than now. So it's it has no end, it has no limit, so you can actually extend the perception of vision through sound in many ways, and that's the main difference between my organic eyes and this electronic eye, that you can actually extend perception in limits that we cannot even know yet. But the main thing is ultraviolet and infrared, perceiving these colors is actually quite useful, especially ultraviolet because it's a dangerous color, and infrared allows me to hear color without light and also to detect if there's any movement detectors in a room, for example. So it's quite interesting, even for people that see color, to hear colors that they can't see.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, because Christina is joining us from Bulgaria this afternoon, and unfortunately can't quite work out the mute and unmute system at the moment, but she's emailed through a question with regard to how has it changed the relationships with people around you? Have you become a more emotional person? So, like, as you're saying, you're seeing and perceiving new things. How has it changed the relationships with people around you?
Well, it's changed everything, because everything sounds, and the way I perceive things have changed. Yeah, people face this sound, so my sense of beauty has changed as well, because if someone looks very good but doesn't sound very good, it might change my perception of that person's face, for example. And it can happen the other way around. Someone very ugly might sound very, very good, and then it might change my perception of his the face. And it happens also with everything around me, like art that maybe I wasn't interested in Rothko or with me, in painters that I would have never been interested, but now that I listen to their artworks, then I'm interested because I like how they sound.
Right. And connected to this, she kind of follows up with that. How can we be sure that the camera and chip give the exact waves for the real colours? For example, she gives this example, when your neighbours at the night switch on the washing machine, you don't hear the noise, but your body perceives the vibrations, and you have dreams in red and orange and things like that. I think it's a bit of broken English there, but how can we be sure that the camera chip gives the exact waves for the real colours? I presume there's been some kind of calibration to know what the colors are transmitting the feelings associated with each color.
Well, color is quite complex. Color is three things at the same time. Color is tone, is light, and it's saturation. So what I hear is the tone of color.
Right.
I don't hear the light, and I don't hear the saturation. I hear the tone, and then the saturation, I hear it by different volume levels, and the light, I see through my eyes. So, for example, a red and a pink might sound exactly the same, but if I see that the object is light, I know it's pink. If the object is dark, then I know it's dark red. So I hear the frequency of the tone. And if we could all hear the frequency of red, we would hear a note between F and F sharp. And the same happens with each note. They are all within less than an octave color frequency. So I hear this relation, the relation of light frequency. If we could hear light frequency, what note would we hear? And that's the note I hear. But then the color is a combination of the note I hear, the volume of saturation I hear, and the light I see.
I see. Pete, do you want to come back in response to what I was exploring with Neil there with regard to the distinction between you and I and the cyborg eye, because it was something that you kind of highlighted?
Well, it's an interesting one, and I'm absolutely with Neil in that we're at the start of these technologies, and it's very difficult to see where they're going to go, and they're only going to get more complex and more capable. It's worth noting, though, that the human eye has an incredible resolution, and the retina picks up thousands of different color spots per millimeter, and then the brain sort of integrates that color to give a very deep perception. When I look out as someone with color vision at a sunset, get a very rich perception of what's going on, and it's quite difficult for me to see how orally that richness of a sun is going to evolve into something in the future. Now, that might be a lack of my perception in seeing how it evolves, but I think the eye is something that has an incredible resolution. Neil's thing is new and is developing and will move on, and the fact it's not bolted in gives it lots of space for development. It's still got to go quite a long way before it approaches the biological. And I guess in terms of enhancement, which is one of the sort of concepts that tends to be associated with cyborg, I then just, it causes questions in my mind as to in what way, I suppose it's back to the therapy or enhancement question, how this moves out of the therapy territory of being something that's really, really good if you have no color perception, into something that is taking the sort of human species to a territory it's never been in before. Not a very well-framed question, more of a comment, but I wonder, Neil, if you have some thoughts around that.
Well, I think it's good to compare ourselves with other animal species and see what senses they have. We don't really need to create any superpowers to become cyborgs. We simply need to copy other animals and just try to sense what they sense. And I think if we could all perceive what other animal species perceive, we would really understand reality and our planet much better. Because even simply the sense, perceiving magnetism to know where the north is, for example, or just extending a bit our sense of smell and our sense of hearing, would really allow us to understand many things that we can probably not even think about now. But like, it can help us a lot, really, just to extend senses. I don't see it as being less human to use technology to extend senses. I see it more as becoming more like other animals, not like machines, but like what other animals can sense already with their senses.
And I think within that, there's an awful lot of latent capability in us. I mean, for a musician, they can train themselves to, you hear really very fine differences. When I'm tuning my violin, I can tell when the string is fractionally out to when it's out, and that's something that you can train in. So I think you're right there. There's a lot of latent capability. And I guess you've been doing pretty much the same yourself as you've been learning to recognize a larger spectrum of color difference. And you just really enhancing your personal ability to pick up and identify the different tones that you've picked up as you look at things.
Yeah, I didn't have a perfect pitch at all when I started hearing color, so it not only has helped me develop a sense of color, it has also enhanced my hearing, because now I can perceive sound better. And this is something that we can all do. Children learn how to differentiate colors, and they have the same ability to differentiate notes, but there doesn't seem to be much interest in schools to teach children to differentiate an F from an A by hearing it. But they are perfectly capable of doing it if they are taught to do it. It's the same. It's as difficult as to differentiate colors, so it's the same process. And it's the same with many other senses. If we start focusing in not extending our knowledge, but also extending our senses, I'm sure it's not as at all complex. We start from an early age.
Okay, if I can just jump in with some other questions from other callers that are wishing me to pose the question as opposed to unmuting themselves and posing it themselves. But Julie would like to ask you, Neil, at what age did you first have the eyeball kind of plugged into you? And then a follow-up to that, have you come across anyone else that either suffered from the same condition that you did, or have taken on your technology that you've developed there and used it for purely enhancement purposes, so they haven't suffered from the same condition that you did, that you could only see in grayscale? They just simply wanted to enhance their capabilities.
Well, I started when I was 21. I started listening to colors when I was 21, and then it's also been tested with completely blind people. They also have this inability to see color. They know what a chair is and they know what a table is, but they don't know what a blue chair is, because then they can't touch it. So they have the same sense of mystery about color. So some blind people use the eye works to perceive color, and also people with complete color blindness. And the interesting thing with blind people is that it actually, if they have seen color before, then it can activate their memory, so they can revisualize color when they hear the notes. Because if they say when you hear this, it's red, they can actually remember red, and they can start revisualizing red, and it has a different effect with them. And also with people that see color, if they use the eye work, then it can actually create a kind of psychedelic effect, because they hear and see color, so it can actually have an effect like kind of drug, but it's only been tested for a few days, but there's a plan of testing it for 6 weeks with people that see color, to see what happens if they hear and see color for 6 weeks.
Right, and it's connecting in with this kind of revisualization of the world, another comment that's come through from Nathan is, how has this changed your opinion about the world? Not quite sure. Well, yeah. How has it changed your opinion about the world and how you perceive it from almost a before and after kind of perspective?
Well, I've had some shocks, like realizing that cities are not grey. When I was taught that, well, most people say that their city is grey, but since I hear color, I realize that cities are really colorful and each city has a dominant color. So I really enjoy detecting the main colors of cities. Also, the fact that people say that humans are black and white is also false. My skin is not white. It's a light shade of orange, and black skins are not black. They are very dark orange as well. So this also was a great discovery for me to see that we are all the same hue. We all share the same hue, which is a shade of orange, but it differs with light, very light or very dark. and many other things that I didn't read about, like that color is also in corners and that actually color is almost everywhere.
Right. So that comment about dominant colours for various cities, can you give some examples? I'm quite fascinated by that. So, for example, I know you've travelled quite widely, but what's the dominant colour of London in contrast to, say, Barcelona or something like that?
Yeah, London is a shade of red and a shade of yellow. Those are the two dominant colours. So, yeah, as I said before, I perceive the dominant colour of a space when I... So what I do is I scan the streets because I detect the dominant color of the streets, and then I can define a city by the dominant colors. Madrid, for example, is amber terracotta. Barcelona is a type of unsaturated blue with a type of ochre. Lisbon is turquoise and light yellow. And each city has a different dominant hue.
Pete, to draw you back in, any comments and reflections on that or anything else that you'd like to follow up with Neil?
I mean, there's an interesting thought through from there. I used to work in Aberdeen. I don't know if you've ever been to Aberdeen.
No, but no.
Because I think that is great, but I'm like... that's my perception of Aberdeen, but it's a bit it would be very interesting if you were there because it's built of grey granite. Now, granite, you know, it has flecks of colour because of the way the rock's put together. And so you get an overall greyness. But it would be very interesting to know what you actually pick out of that. Because as I understand it, the Eyborg goes quiet for... white. Does it also go quiet for black?
Yeah, and for grey.
So you actually looking through somewhere like Aberdeen would ignore the black and the white in the greyness of the granite, but actually pick up the little flecks of colour.
Yeah, it will probably be like very, very unsaturated brown or very, very unsaturated yellow or blue.
Yeah, because the flecks, when you actually look at granite in great detail, are very bright and very dense in colour. Mm-hmm. So your perception of walking through there would be very interesting. It just flicked off in my mind. I was talking with some architects recently about sad building disease, these sort of buildings that... You work in office blocks where the depression levels are higher than normal, and mm-hmm. actually trying to perceive what's going on in those spaces. Is it about layout? Is it about airflow? You know, potentially, is it about colour? And actually, it might be that this sort of tool, this sort of insight, could give some sort of sense as to why some buildings, one of the facets that could make some spaces more or less pleasant to be part of, to live in. One of the things I'd like to explore also is the passport thing and how that came about. And
well, that would be good, Pete, if I can just jump in and say there's some questions specifically coming in about that, so that's good if you can take that forward.
Okay, well, maybe if I throw one out and then Matt, you can see, you know, lead with some of the others. To my mind, what that does is it pushes us in a direction of having to explore the definition of a cyborg. Because there are various prosthetics, people have had facial abnormalities, accidents. There's various ways that people's faces are recorded in passport photographs, which I presume you must be saying aren't cyborg moments, because of your claim that you're the first to be recognized through this way. Or did the passport office actually come out and use the term and say, we are classifying you as a cyborg? So a specific question is to whether the passport office classified you as a cyborg, or two, what is it about this that's different to someone who's got a cochlear implant that you can see the technology in the photo, or a prosthetic face rebuild that you can see in the photo?
Well, first, the difference between the beginning, you talked about glasses, and the main difference between glasses and the electronic eye is that glasses are not a cybernetic device, and that cyborgs are used as a tool, although they can be used for like 16 hours a day. Most people take them out and take them on like a tool. The difference between the electronic eye and a cochlear implant, there's no difference. It's I consider everyone with a cochlear implant a cyborg.
Right.
And I even consider Stephen Hawking as a cyborg because he uses the computer to talk, and we all recognize his voice as a cyborg. The main difference is that I don't know if it has happened with other people with cochlear implants. I don't think they've had to justify their picture, but I wasn't allowed to renew my passport because they saw that I was wearing electronic equipment. So I had to justify that this was not electronic equipment and that I consider it a part of my body. So when I wrote this to them, they asked me for a medical certificate, and then I asked my doctor if he could write a letter explaining that I felt that what they were seeing on the picture was not an electronic equipment but a part of my body, because it had become an extension of my senses. And then after they allowed me to appear on the picture, then many journalists thought that maybe it was the first time that something like this had happened, that someone had to justify that an electronic equipment was a part of their body.
Okay. And so the passport office themselves haven't used the term cyborg within it.
No, it doesn't say...
A classification of conversation that's happened afterwards.
No, I don't think I don't think they have me classified as cyborg. It doesn't even appear on my passport the word cyborg. But the fact that they allowed me to justify that I felt it was a part of my body, that it felt like definition of a cyborg. Yeah.
Okay. So, Matt, what are the other questions that are coming in around that area?
Just wrapping on that topic, it's people were intrigued because I think there's been a news story recently that another country, Ireland, for example, has not recognised your eyeball as part of you, and so it hasn't permitted it to be on your passport photo. Am I correct?
Yeah, exactly. I have two double nationality.
Right.
And I'm still waiting for a reply from the Irish, because I have to renovate my passport this year, and the last time that I had my passport for that, I didn't have the eyeball because it was 2002 or 2001. So now I'm in front of the same situation when I have to explain to them that it's not I don't consider it an electronic equipment.
Right, so have the conversation, and it might be still in its kind of preliminary stage at the moment, but are there any distinguishing factors between the two authorities and the conversation that you're having? For example, is Ireland particularly having a hang-up on a particular aspect, or is questioning something from a different angle that the UK did? I think there's this general interest to see how the two countries are dealing with the situation.
Well, I'm just still waiting for the first reply. I actually sent it more than a month ago, so it's taking a long time, actually. I still don't have a response from them.
I see. Okay.
But I think it might happen the same. I think they also have this norm or law that doesn't allow you to appear on passports with electronic equipment. So I don't know.
And just kind of thinking through, because I've been doing some work recently on biometrics, clearly kind of going through a UK border at the moment is something that's under quite a lot of debate, and quite a lot of focus is being paid to it for various reasons, mainly around security. Have you had to be faced with a situation where you're about to enter a country and they've asked you to remove it to go through an iris scanner or some other biometric type technology.
Yes, but not only in airports, in churches, in supermarkets, in cinemas. There's many places where they don't accept you to have something electronic attached to your body. So the passport really, really helps because the passport shows that it's part of my official image, so no one can actually force me to take it off if it appears on my passport. So if it happens, I just show the passport and I explain what it is.
I mean, presumably physically, you could actually take it off like taking a hat off, can you? It's not, I mean, it just sits on you like a head, so it's that decision not to take it off that's the issue.
Yes, but I really have it strongly attached to my head, so it's not as easy to remove it. It would really take some time to take it off, but yes, it's my decision not to remove a sense, otherwise it would disturb my brain. It's I don't want to stop hearing colors, because the same way you would never stop seeing colors.
Right.
I don't like having to remove a sense of my body, so I feel it has to stay permanently attached to my body.
I suppose, picking up on that, Neil, but you know, we're talking about, I can understand where Pete was coming in his comments, it's a bit like a hat, you could take it in and take it off, is it just you clarified the fact that it's not as simple as that. What are the consequences, though, of detaching and reattaching it? Because would it be simply a case of that sense going and then coming back again? Or is there kind of almost a shutdown period? And I hate using, with Pete's point at the beginning, ringing in my ears, inappropriate words, but I'm just thinking, is it just a shut-on, shut-off sense, or is it going to affect you in some other way, that kind of sort of having to develop the sensation again and cause you other pain or discomfort?
No, because, for example, if I run out of battery, sometimes I simply run out of battery and I stop, the iWork stops giving me colors, so I need to plug myself, but during those minutes when I'm not plugged, there's my brain keeps creating electronic sounds even though the eye doesn't create them, because my brain is so used to hearing constantly electronic sounds since 2008 that even if I cover the eye with my hand, I can still hear colors because my brain will create them even if they're not true to the colors that I have in front of me. So I'm never really without color, even if the eye work stops for a few seconds.
So it's almost a sort of form of tinnitus at that point. It carries on even though there isn't a stimulus around.
Yes.
What do you think is going to happen when you embed a peg into the bone? So that you get a purer transmission of sound through to the bone. Do you have a view as to how that's going to change your ability to differentiate or sense in a clearer manner?
Yeah, because the difference between audio sounds and visual sounds will be much greater. And when the sound goes in the bone, it will resonate all around the head, so it will be much more stronger. Then I won't have this constant pressure at the back of my head. It will be much more comfortable. And the biggest and most important thing is that this project will become a medical project. It will be a medical thing. It will happen in a hospital. So many people, many blind people and people that can't see color or people that want to extend their visual perception, they will be able to do it through a doctor and by going to a hospital and having an electronic eye implanted.
And has this is this subject to is this a personal operation, or is it part of an ethics approval panel in the way that it's putting it together as an experiment?
Well, I had to justify that I thought that this was ethical, yes, in front of 14 doctors almost a year ago, and it took them many months to decide whether it was ethical or not. And now they said yes just 2 weeks ago. They said that they want to do it. So they find that it can have many other applications, because if you change the chip, for example, and you ask the chip to read words instead of reading colors, it means it might be the end of Braille. You don't need to translate books into Braille. You can use an electronic eye that can read any word in front of you. And it's the same with distances. Instead of detecting color, it can detect distances, so it can help people detect if there's an object in front of you. And it can actually, there's many, many different applications that you can use. It's good because instead of using applications for mobile phones, you can use applications for your own body now.
Nice. Well, without keeping an eye on the time as well now, because we tend to have these calls for just under an hour or just over. So we're coming to the final kind of 10 or so minutes. Anyone else who wants to raise a question, please do email it through to me, matt.james@bioethics.ac.uk. One's coming from Aaron. It takes us further into kind of the field that Neil's particularly involved with. And Aaron was kind of asking further clarity or further comments from you, Neil, about Cyborgian Techniques as an art movement. Obviously taking in the fact that you also are an artist and are using these technologies in an art form. Would you like to kind of, expand upon that and to offer some comments as you see that developing?
Well, I think it can actually be seen as an art movement, cyborgism. It's the fact that artists modify their senses, and with the modification of their senses, they start creating art through a new sense. So it can be seen as an art movement, and also a way of, like in the 20th century, many artists took drugs to create, or they created art through the influence of drugs. Now using technology applied to your body can be a substitute of drugs to many people, because it can have a similar effect, but in a more controlled way, and you can actually play much more around this sensory extension.
And presumably, this is an area that interests you. Just to give a kind of a feel for people that perhaps aren't so aware of this emerging field, are there many cyborgs or people that are engaging in this technology in it as a specific art form? Is there a kind of growing movement, and kind of what's being produced in this kind of whole field?
Yeah, there's people that incorporate technology as an experimental art form, and they use for performances. They use technology in order to create new expressions with the union between body and machine. But I don't think there's a growing amount of people doing it yet. But hopefully, I think that this generation that is growing, I think they will start losing this fear of using technology as part of the body. It's the main problem of the people of the people that have grown in the 20th century. We've been watching films and comics and books that have that transmit this fear of the union between humans and machines, and I think this is slowly disappearing, this fear.
Okay. Pete, thank you upon you for kind of some final comments and reflections just as we kind of wrap the call up. But perhaps the question that I'd like to pose to both of you, and therefore give you a bit of time to kind of prepare, is how you see this kind of technology panning out in the next 10 years. Clearly, it is fairly new, but it is developing, and even in the case that we have of Neil, he can testify to how the technology has kind of developed even a relatively short space of time that he's been using it and applying it in his own life. So to Neil, how do you see this kind of technology panning out over the next 10 years? What perhaps some of the major challenges or maybe questions we need to be thinking about. And to you yourself, Pete, as well as somebody who's kind of a commentator in this whole field, who's done research about various people pushing the boundaries and developing technology in this way, what do you think are some of the kind of the key issues that are emerging at this time? So, yes, I don't think anyone, let me just check my email, has come in with any other comments. No. So I think we'll just draw the line there. It's now closed. No more emails, please, as we draw the call to a close. But yes, to both of you, perhaps starting with Pete, how do you see the future unfolding over the next 10 years? What are the kind of key challenges to us?
Well, I think undoubtedly we're going to have an increased range of sensors that can detect all sorts of different signals that are out in the world, whether it's light, whether it's temperature, whether it's sound, where it fits into the electromagnetic spectrum. Interesting thing for me is actually then making that as you can sense and detect how that gets passed on into the body. Most of the techniques at the moment tap into an existing sense, so Neil's taps into the existing sense of hearing, others tap into senses of touch, and what we're allowing within this is our existing senses to be redirected in a variety of different ways. So I think the range of things we can direct our senses to, the thing that's critical though that I find always fascinating within it is that it's still dependent on using one of our biological senses and using an incredibly capable and at times untapped latent ability within that natural biological sense and bolting something else onto that to stretch its capability even further. So I find this intriguing, I find it exciting, and I think it points in two directions. One, to how innovative the human animal is at creating tools, and the other is how incredible the human animal is at being capable of creating these tools and then using them when they're around.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Pete. And Neil, how do you see the future panning out in the next 10 years, and what do you think are kind of some of the key questions that we need to be thinking from this call as well as longer term that we need to be thinking about more carefully?
Well, I think we should stop thinking about technology as a tool and start thinking about it as a part of our body. I think this is the biggest thing that should be happening in the next 10 years. I don't see the use of mobile phones as a practical thing in the future to keep using our hands to know things, to keep using our pockets to keep things, electronic things. We have a many space in our body. We can really use it to extend senses and perceptions. It will be much more practical and actually much cheaper because you don't need to create an external device to give you information. You can use your own body. So I think this is the biggest challenge, that we have to change the way people see now the union between technology and body. And there's many senses that we can actually create that we don't have. I feel that I'm not using the sense of hearing. I'm using a different sense of hearing because to me it's very different to hear through my ears than to hear through my bones. So I feel that I've gained a new sense because hearing sounds through the bone is something very new. It's different. It's a bit tickly. It has a vibration, and it actually, you can hear more than an ear if you use your bones. So we could all extend a new sense and hear different things through the bone. There's also senses that we don't have, like magnetism perception, and this is one of the things that I think we should start to experiment with in the next few years.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, as I said at the beginning, this call has been recorded and will be out some minor edits, perhaps, just getting that ready to be able to download and play online for you. Those that have joined the call this afternoon, I'll be emailing to say when that's available online. You may also like to, and I'll give opportunity to in that email, if you're not already part of our mailing list, to sign up, be part of that, and be aware of future events that we'll be holding, not only here as thought leader at our conferences, but also the more physical kinds that we still deal in, based in London and in other parts of the country. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us this afternoon. I'm sure we've had a very stimulating, interesting and informative afternoon's discussion online, and discussing the whole issue of Neil's cyborgs and enhancements. So thank you for joining us, and thank you most importantly to our contributors, Neil Harbison and Pete Moore. Thank you very much, and wish you a very pleasant afternoon. Thank you.